Well, probably all of you are better qualified than I am to speak on a heart for God. I thought back. Now, what was the first time I ever thought about having a heart for God? And the only thing that popped in my mind is my first thought of when I didn't have a heart for God. I remember the first conference I was at. It was out in Sioux City, Iowa. And they had this place they called the Chicken Coops. You know, much like this, you know. Everybody slept in the same room. You know, it was just bunks. You kind of stepped on one bunk to get to another. It was just kind of a barn, almost as big as this. But about 5:30 in the morning, you know, everybody started getting up, and I looked at my watch and jumped on top of my bed, and I said, "Hey, everybody, let's get back in bed. Your watches are wrong. It's only 5:30. So that was my introduction to a quiet time. But as far as having a heart for God, back in those days, I didn't. But I thought this evening that we get most of your thoughts about the heart for God. So I'd like to give you about 3 minutes to look at those first two questions on what do you think of when you say that someone has a heart for God. We want to begin thinking alike here. You know, we can use, well, so this person has a heart for God, but what do you think of when a person says about somebody else they have a heart for God? And secondly, what event in the past has shown you that you have a heart for God? What has been a testimony to yourself in realizing, you know, I'm ready to get my heart for God? Let's take about 2 minutes and look at that. Write them down. How do you know that?
Okay, expressed by his sharing of it verbally with others.
Okay. The sharing, the way he speaks about God. Raj?
Person loves to spend time in the Word.
Okay. So it's his attitude. Attitude toward the Word. Okay. Okay. Priority of time. He's always got time to spend with God. He's top priority. Okay. Okay. Application. When these hard decisions come about, how does he make them?
The commitment in that he wants to go where God is. And my experience was I couldn't find God where I was, but I knew where I could find him. So commitment to go there and get help.
Okay. How about go after help? As related to God. Leon?
Concerns for the lost.
Okay. What his concerns are? Concern for the lost? Any other concerns?
I was going to say have a love for God.
How is that expressed? How do you tell a guy loves God?
He's excited about God. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably the way he's sharing it. And, okay. Bob, what were you going to say? Okay, he loves. person who loves God must love people. You can't love God who loves people without loving people. Burn?
The consuming thought on your mind during a span of time, a day's time span, what's the most prevalent thing in your mind?
Okay. His thought life. Boy, the things you think about is definitely the tells what's on your heart. Okay. It's not that he just prays. I mean, there's prayer books and monks and everything, but how would you put that?
Spends time with God in prayer.
Uh-huh. Okay. How about
talking with God?
Mm-hmm. He shares his own life with God. Shares his life in the life of others. Prayer. Heart sharing. I think we could say.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he has a very attitude of a very needy person. If there's anything that the Bible should make us into, it's a needy person. Well, the more you get close to God, you see how needy you are. How does he respond? I mean, how would you know? Would that be God putting his finger on something and he applies it? Okay, you got Ruth Myers' tape in there. But how does knowing God's love cure you? D?
Maybe he's sensitive to others, other-centered. I think being confident in God's love would make a person accept himself and others and make him
how about a secure person?
Yeah, that's another word. Yeah.
Okay. Seems like a person who really comprehends the love of God is a very secure. They're at peace with themselves, they're at peace with God. They're at peace with the world. Bob?
I was just saying that line, they're genuine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's... growing, what, honesty or genuineness?
Yeah, openness or genuineness.
Okay. There's just a growing transparency.
Hate for sin.
Okay. Growing hate for sin. Okay, we begin to get an idea of what we're talking about. But a heart for God, you can see, is not something that's kind of theoretical and, you know, ooziness, but it has real application. It shows itself in life. It's impossible to have a heart for God and not have it demonstrated in your life. It's not a mystical thing. So as you look back on your own life, what are some things of which have come about in your life that you felt really showed you that you're beginning to have a heart for God?
Starting to get up more quiet at night.
Uh-huh. Okay, it went from legalism to a desire to do it. Okay? Took me about 3 months.
Spent more time in prayer.
Okay, your time in prayer began being more spontaneous. Okay. Bern? Okay, that's one we didn't mention here, is a growing thankfulness. Okay, George?
A real desire to please God.
Okay. How was that demonstrated? Yeah. Want to find out something, what God's mind was, or the will of God, or... being concerned about God's heart.
What would God say about your desire to spend time with God? Let me see what my joy or delight to
spend time with God. Yeah. Every now and then I just kind of wake up and realize, hey, it's been quite a while since I got carried away in prayer. You know, just enjoying it so much that I forgot what time it was. And I began praying that this would happen again. Leon? Was there a real revelation when you realized that? Kind of scare you a little?
Deeper and deeper conviction.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Raj? That I desire to be around men and women who have a heart for God.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing you just like to be around people with a like heart? Just work at it. Okay, Dan?
Just taking steps to allow yourself depth, training, or I can just look back on my life and taking, just allowing myself to be available to God, wherever He wanted me to go, whoever He wanted me to be under, so I could be in His training.
Good. Bob?
I was going to say the same thing.
Okay. Okay, heart that isn't influenced by anyone except God as number one influence. Okay, we're beginning to see how a heart for God is exemplified. But what we often do not see is how much our concept of God has to do with our real relationship with Him. This next question, I think, is very key because a lot of times we talk to people and they say, yeah, I believe in God, and they're Christians or non-Christians, but we really don't know what kind of a God they really believe in. And I took a couple examples here. That is that Christianity is a father-son relationship, while... for example, Islam is a judge And I didn't know what word to use, defendant type of relationship. And in Seventh-day Adventism, often in Judaism, many Christians have a judge type of God. And so consequently, there are certain relationships of which you carry on because of your basic concept of God. And so we've gotten down to the basic concept. Let's do a little comparing here. Write down the comparing of a relationship of a father and son or father and daughter to a judge and defendant. How do they relate to each other? What are emotions involved? What are duties? What are responsibilities? And then the next question is, what are some desires a father has for his son or daughter? Okay, I'll give you about 5 minutes and think on these. First of all, what are some characteristics of a father-son relationship or father-daughter relationship? Danny? Okay. Pre-communications. Okay, now if you grew up having a hard time communicating with your father, it's very likely that you have a hard time communicating with God, really pouring out your heart to Him, that you have a hesitancy. It's very likely.
It's not based on right or wrong, then.
Okay. Then it's a grace relationship.
Based on love.
Okay. Love.
Acceptance.
Grace. Acceptance. Mm-hmm. Acceptance not based on performance type of relationship. It's what?
Routine rather than special contact. In other words,
you have a routine relationship?
Routine, I mean, like an everyday affair, not
okay, it's.
Versus the
court
trial,
versus the band. It's.
Routine, the everyday walk.
How about spontaneous?
Okay. Daily. Spontaneous type relationship. Mm-hmm. Bob?
Very personal as opposed to impersonal.
Okay. Very personal.
Freedom to show, to express emotions and feelings.
Okay. How about free communications and emotions and word? Okay. Dave?
Protecting. Father protects his
son. Okay. There's a care. The father is care, will care for his son. That's just accepted. You know, my son really clings to me. He knows where his care comes from when any dangers come.
Father-son correction comes for training, judge defendant.
Okay. It's okay. Why don't we switch over here and just kind of compare the two? How about the communications, usually in a judge defendant? Okay, it's either mechanical,
impersonal.
Often down here at 4, impersonal,
limited or restricted.
Okay, restricted, I think that's probably the best word there, restricted. They're Remember, the Jews always had certain restrictions that they felt if they didn't have the sacrifice, they couldn't do it, or if their works weren't such and such. So there, naturally, it's a relationship of works. Okay. Law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I can think of that as what binds them together with the Father, Son. It's something on the inside, and with the judge and the defendant, it's something that's on the outside of both of them.
Okay. So it's outside, where this would be more inside, inward. Let's see, training versus punishment.
As far as the judge and defendant, there's no heart or sensitivity involved.
Okay, that's be the impersonalness of it. There, let's see, the third one, daily routine. More, how about duty? Would duty be the, do the thing? Yes.
With the Father and Son, the Son is reflecting on the Father. With the judge, the reflection.
Okay, let's see, how would we put that? There's a concern about the Father's reputation. You know, I look back on my childhood, and a number of reasons why I didn't get into more trouble than I did was that I really concerned it hurt my mother. There was a real concern of that more than anything else, I think. Bob? Heal versus reveal. Yeah. Yeah, have you ever noticed that if something is revealed without healing, it just, it's covered up again? Comes out in another form?
It's a relationship with fear and authority.
Okay. Love versus fear.
Along with grace and law, the basis for forgiveness in the Father and Son is love, the basis for forgiveness, and the other is judicial punishment.
Okay. That'd go along with your punishment training or changing, wouldn't it? Yes.
This may be just another way of looking at seven. It's an inward versus outward thing. But in a judge-defendant relationship, the concern is for external appearance and for action. Whereas the father, son, the father is more concerned about character.
Okay. Character. I guess we could put back in six there, outward, let's see, actions, especially. Okay, you might just look at your own concept of God. Most of us kind of have an intermixture of this. And because we've had an inadequate experience so often, because no one has a perfect father, then our concept of our Father is often very inadequate. And so we begin relating to God this way. If you had a very authoritarian father, then probably you have a lot of trouble with works, being legalistic. And I found in my own life that mine's rather a combination of these. But, yes.
Would you say then, Lauren, that our relationship with God is purely Father and Son? It does not have, it should not have, that it's any judge-dependent character?
Right. Before we became Christians, it's judge-dependent. We're under law before we become Christians. Then we're under grace. I'd say yes. And because all of us seem to be in the process of really living under grace, we usually have a combination of those in our everyday experience. So this is why sermons like on the curativeness of love hit home so much, is because our need to make this transfer of living under a love relationship rather than a law relationship. Let's turn in our Bibles to, I'm going to preach to you just for a few minutes here. Psalm 63. I'd like to just whet our appetites on this psalm. And I'd like you to take your sheet tomorrow and take this question 7. And tomorrow morning in your quiet time, just meditate on this psalm and note some of the characteristics of a person with a heart for God. I was told we were going to have an hour and a half for this, so I was going to have you break up into some groups here and discuss some of the characteristics from this psalm, but because we had a half-hour introduction, we'll just cut that out and include that. Ask you to include that in your quiet time. But I'd like to just look at three thoughts here, and that's from verse 1. Here's a man who's talking about a very personal God. Oh my God, thou art my God. I seek thee. My soul thirsts for thee. My flesh faints for thee. In a dry and weary land where there's no water. A man with a heart for God seems to have a thirst for God. My soul thirsts for God. You know, as Har put up in the picture of the heart, this is usually the picture of the soul. It's divided into three parts, the mind, the emotions, and the will. So ask yourself, you know, here's a picture of a man going through the desert, and I've never been really thirsty. So that I just ache in thirst. But they say that thirst is one of the strongest desires a person can have. But do you have a thirst? In your mind, do you want to know more and more about God? In your emotions, do you want to experience God more daily? In your will, do you find that you want to conform your will to the will of your Heavenly Father? A thirst for God. And look up in verse 5. It says, my soul is feasted as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth praises thee with joyful lips. This word in the American, I believe it says, my soul is satisfied. In other words, when I feast on God, am I satisfied? Do I find satisfaction for the answers to my questions? And do I find that the Lord meets my emotional needs? That my heart really is satisfied with Him? And my will, does my will, when He makes known His personal will for me, is there just that satisfaction that is really acceptable, perfect? You know, as it says in Romans 12, 1 and 2, my soul is satisfied with God. And verse 8, my soul clings for thee. your soul there for the long haul. You know, and all the novelties of the navigators wear off, all the new little tricks for getting in the Word and having a devotional life and walking with God and methods and everything. When it comes down to it, when all these have lost their newness, is there just that, God, I'm in this for the long haul. My mind is with you whether I get all the answers or not. I remember I had one question about the Word of God that it was 9 years before I had an answer to it. But there was just that clinging that even though I don't have an answer, God, I believe your Word. And I found the answer 9 years ago. My emotions cling. When I'm defeated, when I feel ungodly, when I feel that the world is against me, which it is. But not only that, my friends, the navigators, everybody, you know, when you just feel like you've had it, is there just a clinging to God? Well, everybody else is against me, but Lord, you said that I'll never leave you or forsake you. That clinging of the emotions and that will, because God said it, I just believe it. I don't know why. God never promised the answer everything, but I know, and so to speak, when all the wash is in, God will stand true. Because that's who He is. Well, I look at this psalm and see some of the characteristics of a man that has a heart for God. But when I ask myself, do I have a heart for God? I always come up with a reverse question. Does God have a heart for me? Because, you know, you can have a heart for somebody. Probably all of you have been interested in somebody along your life of romance where they couldn't care less about you. And your heart for them really didn't meet with much response. Well, when you begin looking at your own life, you begin realizing that God has a tremendous investment in you. Can you imagine just how many Christians there are in the world who haven't had the training you've had? Boy, God must really have a personal interest in you. And I'd like to just share three verses and close with a fourth verse. And the first one is John 16:15. You have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and ordained you that you should go and bring forth fruit. Your striving and everything you are learning about the ministry is cultivated by God. And it isn't going to be that which produces fruit. He says, I have chosen you to bear fruit. And I look back at my own life. I mean, why did God ever choose me, you know? I mean, here I am, a little kid who spent 2 years in the first grade. You know, here was one class, and here's another class, and here I was in both of them. You know, if you're going to choose somebody to have an impact for Christ, I mean, why me, Lord? And I look at my high school. You know, here were 244 kids in my senior class, and only 222 of them made it. And here I was, right in the middle, 111. You know, I just average guy. You know, if I was going to choose somebody, you know, to have an investment in people's lives, but if I was God, I don't think I had chose me. You know, I mean, I didn't learn to read till I was about fourth grade, I think. I read my first book when I was in the fifth grade. You know? But God chooses. You know, you you can't understand why God chooses. I look at it back in the first Bible study that I was in. There are about 50 kids that come out for Bible study. And I wasn't even a Christian at that time. I remember going up and down the dorms. I was president of the dormitory, so I could get away with about anything. So I'd walk up and down the dorms. Hey, anybody want to go to Bible study? So I'd walk up and down the halls. That's how I recruit people. Well, get over there to Bible study, and boy, there was Marv. Marv had a tremendous heart for God, it seemed like to me. He had a whole box full of verses, and he was the one who got all this going. There was 50 people around, you know. And 4 years later, Marv was bartending in California last when I saw him. He turned against God, but he'd gotten all this going. I mean, why wasn't Marv chosen? Or Jim? Boy, that was a guy who I saw getting in the Bible, who in high school he wanted to be a missionary. He went to seminary, be a missionary. He went to the mission field, and his wife just wasn't with him. And I talked to him a few months ago, and he said, boy, my wife doesn't even want people in my house. She's no hospitality. She just wants to go to church, sing in the choir, and teach little kids. But anything besides that is related to our home. She doesn't want any part of it. I mean, well, why? Jim had such a heart for God, I can't believe it. I mean, why is he doing very little now for God? And I think back over the Nav area I was in. You know, here, there's not one person, I don't think, around the Navigators who were close in at that time that's around the Navigators today. Almost all of them went off on a doctrinal problems and completely eliminated themselves. Many of them aren't even walking with God, and some of them are still walking with the Lord and accomplishing very little. You know, why me? You know, why am I still in the battle? The only thing I can think of is this: you have not chosen me, but I have chosen you. God has a heart for us. I remember old Red Harper, used to be with the Sons of the Pioneers, kind of the cowboy singer. I remember him saying, I was talking to God the other day, and he says, you know, Red? I thought, isn't that great? He knows my name. Yeah, he knows our name. You know, it might be Tom, might be Dee, Raj, Ellie, you know, but he knows your name personally. He has chosen you. I have chosen you. And over again, you come to the question, why me, Lord? And you have to say, well, here am I, Lord, send me. Then I look at another verse, 1 Peter 1:5. It says, who are kept by the power of God. I look back how God has really kept me. I remember my youth group that I was in. And he kept me from doctrinal error, in that the sponsor of the youth group was a Unitarian. And we used to talk all the time. And I thought, well, he believes about the way I do. But when I started reading the Bible, there was an immediate response to the person of Christ. Now, why wasn't I drawn into this? I look at my relatives, and one's a Mormon, another one's a Catholic, another one's nothing, and a very strong nothing. And my father has nothing to do with Christ. No. But I mean, why have I been kept? I look at the sin I could have gotten into. It could have completely destroyed my life. I remember a girl asking me to go to a motel with her and turn her down. Why? You know, we're kept by God. I can remember traveling on a vacation and in California. And I never had temptations like I did on this trip. You know, I just getting away from the NAB work for a while. I just took about 3 days of vacation. And boy, every time I passed a bar, it seemed like something kept saying, "Hey, stop and have a beer. Hey, stop and have a beer." You know? I couldn't believe it. And then as I got toward San Francisco, I wasn't going to San Francisco, and it kept coming, "Why don't you go to burlesque shows in San Francisco? Why don't you go to burlesque shows in San Francisco?" Over. You know, temptation I never had in my life before or since. You know, but we're kept by the power of God, by faith. God keeps us. And I think of all the times that I could have had bitterness. You know, about all of us think that sometime or another that somebody around the Navigators or something has dealt you the wrong hand, shall we say. You know, we can always find somebody who we could be bitter toward. And I go through a number of experiences of which I look back now, boy, I could have easily developed a very bitter attitude. But why? I don't know. It wasn't because my heart was so pure. I guess I was just too dumb sometimes to become bitter. But God keeps you. And just the area of quitting. Well, I can remember up first time I was sent out as a contact point, and I was sent out twice as a contact point, actually three times. I was sent out as a contact point once before they had contact points, and then they decided to have contact points. And then when I was about done with my contact point experience, they wrote out the qualifications for being having an acceptable contact experience, in other words, a job description, of which they wrote out when I was about done and found out that I didn't qualify, so I went out again. But anyway, I can remember being up by myself, you know, hundreds of miles to the nearest navigator, and every man that I worked with, they got going, and two of them went in the ministry, but that left me with nobody, and I didn't have anybody to talk to. I remember just telling God, "God, take away this loneliness." And that whole next year, there was only about 2 hours in my life that I was lonely. But there was a lot of times when I felt like, you know, quitting, but are kept by the power of God. And when you realize you're kept by the power of God, it seems like the response that always comes to my heart, "God, don't give up on me. Don't give up on me." We're kept by the power of God. And the third one is that verse that Harv shared, Philippians 1:6. "That I'm sure that he who has begun a good work in me will perform it." In other words, will perfect it until the day of Jesus Christ. that I look back on my life and God has continued to perfect things. I look back on some hard decisions. I remember when I got out of seminary, I had an offer to be assistant pastor of a church, and another one was to go to work for a religious book company, of which one paid about $10,000, the other paid about I think it was $8,500 back in those days. That was quite a bit more than the average. And then I had an offer to be a janitor in a servicemen center. Well, I had to evaluate what the greatest need in my life was. It wasn't being a janitor. It was learning how to do evangelism. And so I look back on God causing me to make a decision of which had repercussions for the rest of my life. It wasn't the most glamorous one. But God helps us to make these decisions. In just my daily life, I remember last year when I had to face some things of which had to do with authority in my life. Some of you had to apologize to your parents after you got through the Gothard seminars. Well, finally, after I went to two of them, and I began realizing, hey, you know, I need to apologize to my father. Well, I didn't want to do that, I'll tell you. My dad, I could think of more things wrong with him and why I shouldn't. But basically what he thought of me was that I was a very ungrateful son. And, you know, I thought of him, I thought he was a very proud, arrogant father. And so, it began hitting me. Well, if I think that my father is proud and arrogant, and my father thinks I'm ungrateful, and it says sin goes on to the third and fourth generation, what will my son think? I got a very proud and arrogant father. I got a very ungrateful son. It'd go on. Boy, it hit me that there has to be an act of grace to break that chain. So one of the hardest things I ever did was apologize to my father. And then just in the area of government, you know, I always thought I had it pretty squared away. You know, it was never a problem with government, obeying government. But I stopped in this little town when I was visiting one of the contact points in Iowa. And I just ran in the store for 1 minute, ran back out, and I had a ticket. Well, you know, these little towns. So I drove off and tried to forget the ticket. But I didn't forget it, but I kept trying to forget it. Well, then the summer came. And I was in Columbus, Ohio. And I drove my wife downtown. It was about 4:15. And there were about 6 or 7 cars in the street. So I pulled up and looked around. No signs about around. So I jumped out of the car, put some money in the parking meter, and Marilyn and I went into a store. We came back 15 minutes later, and here was a ticket on my car. And I walked down and saw this sign who some kid had bent the wrong direction. And it says, no parking after 4 o'clock. Well, all these cars were here at 4 o'clock. This was 15 minutes after, and all of them were there. And my parking meter still had an hour left in it. Then I turned over my parking ticket, and it said, $20 fine. $20. Well, 2 days later, the program got over, so I was thinking, well, boy, you know, it's God's money, you know. Let's not waste it like this. And as I was driving out of town, I flipped on the radio and it says, 654,000 people in the city of Detroit did not pay parking tickets last year. I thought, well, you know, everybody does it. Well, after about a week, you know, I thought, well, I better, why don't I write him a letter why I shouldn't pay this thing? And so I wrote this 2-page letter, and I set it on my desk, and I couldn't mail it. And I knew what God was talking to me about. So finally, I put my $20 in there and dug out another envelope and put my $1 in and finally got it squared away. But I know that God is going to perfect what He's begun because He keeps making me face hard things, which I don't especially want to face. But he says He would. And also I know that God is perfecting is because I love my job. I love what I'm doing. I love what I'm involved in. I love the vision. And I can't give it up. I just read an article about Roland Bingham, the founder of Sudan Interior Mission. And when he had this vision for Africa, the inland of Africa. So he recruited two other men to go over there. And they landed on the coast of Africa, and before they even got into the interior of Africa, two of the men were already dead of fever and sickness. And so he went back to recruit a couple more. So he recruited three more. Well, he got over there and got so sick that he had to come back home. Within 2 weeks, the other men came back on the boat. Well, he almost died then, but he got back on the boat, started in third time, and about a year of sickness, almost died a number of times. But he had a vision that he just couldn't give up because God had implanted it on his heart. And God has implanted a vision in my heart of raising up disciples, of which I can't get away from. And he says, he'll perfect that which he's begun. And so all I can say is, Lord, make me like your son. And it's all summarized in 1 John 4:10. Not that I love God, but that he loves me. That's the amazing thing. A heart for God is wrapped up in God's heart. It's God who has such a heart for us. It's God who keeps us. It's God who has chosen us. It's God who longs to have fellowship with us. It's God who finds heart satisfaction in what he does out of a dirty vessel. How he can change that vessel into a vessel of glory. It's God who's going to perfect. Having a heart for God is not that we love God, but that he loves us. So as we close, why don't we look at this questions 5 and 6. And I want you to close on 6 because this is positive. What do you enjoy most about the Christian life? The other part, the dangers. So why don't we have a word of prayer? Why don't you do a little thinking on this, and then when you're done, just take off. Heavenly Father,